You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 12th of April 2022 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. This is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, Shanghai begins easing lockdown measures for its 26 million inhabitants. We'll have the latest from China's most populous city. We'll hear from our contributor on the ground in Ukraine. And then... lots of pomp and circumstance as North Korea celebrates 10 years since Kim Jong-un assumed the top post of the country's ruling Workers' Party. We'll also be finding out why a new exhibition at London's Design Museum is celebrating the beautiful game.
As the fan is such a central component of football culture, and you really don't get that level of fan engagement, I don't think, in any other sport. And that was definitely important for us to showcase and highlight in this exhibition.
We'll be putting it in the back of the net, all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. The US and the UK say they are looking into reports that chemical weapons have been used by Russian forces attacking Mariupol. It comes amid warnings that Russia is preparing to mount a huge offensive in eastern Ukraine. Well, I'm joined now by Natalia Khumenyuk, who is a Ukrainian journalist and author. Natalia, thanks very much for calling in. Last night, the Ukrainian president gave an address to the South Korean parliament in which he said Russian troops had destroyed Mariupol. There are tens of thousands of dead. Even despite this, the Russians are not stopping their offensive, he said. I wonder what more you can tell us about the situation in this southern port city.
So, to explain it better, the city is under the heavy shelling and under the siege since the 2nd of March. So it's more than a month. It's been constantly shelled by all kind of the weaponry. We're speaking about the air bombs. We're speaking about all kind of the strikes. Since then, there is neither electricity nor water, as the substation had been destroyed back then, and the shops, you know, with the products had been destroyed back then, including the emergency service. So more or less since the end of March, the evacuation wasn't like allowed for the first 20 days. People were not even able to leave the city. It's not yet still negotiated. So a little by little, people are moving out. In that town, there were in the beginning of the war, 500,000 people living. We knew that around the 10 days ago, there were still around 120,000 people. And since there is no, the Ukrainian side didn't manage to get the Russian agreement for some kind of a green corridor, the people were just, you know, living with their own cars. So it couldn't be massive. And we are getting more information from the people coming from Mariupol. It's true. And we already were able to see, for instance, the drone footage. Yeah, where we do see that a 90% the town is basically, we can see the skeleton of numerous buildings. It's quite a big industrial port. More than some time ago, talked to the governor of the Donetsk region, who said back then that there were up to 100,000 people who've been evacuated to the Ukrainian side. The city is divided by the river, so up to 40,000 at least were forcefully removed to Russia because they were not allowed to get to another side. So that's what we know, but the humanitarian situation is drastic. It's really not really possible to deliver anything to the town for such a long period of time. However, it's a very important strategic place, territory-wise, so the fights are there. Mariupol isn't occupied by Russia, so there are the fights, also the street fights in the city, because partially there are Ukrainian troops remaining there.
And there have been reports of chemical weapons. Do we have any more information on that?
No, we do not have. We have some, announcement, but we couldn't independently verify it in any way.
Now, I know that you've been out visiting.
But just to remind that we hear more often from the Russian, propagandistic media that, for instance, allegedly Ukraine would use the chemical weapon. So that makes Ukrainians very concerned, because usually when this happens, we know that Russia does something and accusing Ukraine of something they do. So when this rhetoric appears on possible use of the chemical weapon, we extremely, and the government and everybody's extremely concerned, would it be used as a pretext?
Mm. You've been out visiting some of the towns and the villages near Kiev, like near Kiev. What did you find there?
First of all, yeah, I think it's worth it to stress that these are quite a large towns. We're speaking about the cities which were under shelling, where probably 100,000 people were living in the residential area, which are Kiev suburbs. They are, by the way, coming back to life. So, for instance, the famous bridge, there was a lot of pictures when months ago the people were trying to escape and were hiding behind, under the broken bridge. It's about being repaired, people coming back, but there is investigation. There are searches for the mass graves of the civilians who've been killed. The investigation shows that many of them, apart from the people who died from the shelling, were, for instance, shot. So we're speaking about the execution and about hundreds of people dying in these ways. We see that in every single town which were, there are two types of the problem. The towns which were not under the Russian control, that they were basically destroyed by the shelling. The towns which were under the, because they were shelling under the Russian control, we hear about these executions and people, the houses has been looted. But it's not just about Kiev. I spent last 2 days in the area near Chernihiv, which is a town up north, just 70 kilometers away from both Russian border and the Belarus border. The city is trying to be back to life. There is no still water, but there is already electricity. Everybody tries to kind of be back to life as fast as possible after the occupation. We also record numerous cases of either people had been shot on the checkpoint, or they were I'm speaking about the civilians, or the villages where the houses were basically destroyed. So I've seen that level of destruction. So it's really omnipresent, and we're speaking about quite a large territory, but concern is again the same. Giving you an example, we've been in one of the villages where for 1 month the Russian soldiers were staying, and they really told to the locals that, we are now withdrawing, because they were pushed also by the Ukrainian army, they weren't able to capture the towns, but they are telling that we are regrouping and we would go to the battles in the Donbas, where everybody is expecting, unfortunately, the most possibly the fiercest fights of this war in quite a short time.
And do you think that battle in Donbas will be very different from those fought around Ukrainian cities previously, given that it's different terrain and so on?
We don't think it would be, let's say, very different, because we already see what's happening in the occupied areas and the cities. We already observe the shellings in, Mariupol is a part of the Donbas. We just see the same tactics would be moved to other towns. We also understand that, the same strategy of destroying the water pumps, destroying of the electricity and any civilian infrastructure will take place. But it's true that the most, capable battle, the battle troops of Ukraine are based there. There was a conflict, but in a different scale for the last 8 years. But the concern is there would be way, way more Russian troops there. Also, they control the territory there for a long time, for 8 years. So that could be the attacks both from, east, from south, and from the sea.
That's Natalia Khomenyuk. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24. It's just coming up to 12 minutes past 7 here in London. That's 9:12 in Helsinki, which is where we're off to next. Russia's unprovoked attack on Ukraine has prompted a security rethink in both Finland and Sweden. The only non-NATO Nordic countries look set to consider joining the military alliance, upending decades of neutral policy. Charlie Salonius-Pasternak is a senior research fellow at the Global Security Research Programme at the Finnish Institute of International Affairs in Helsinki and joins me now. Charlie, could you start by giving us some background to Finland's previous relationship with Russia, with which it shares over 800 miles of frontier?
Well, of course, a number of wars in history, most recently two separate ones during the Second World War. And ever since then, an effort to have functional relations. So sometimes they're translated as good relations. Yes, of course, you'd like to have good relations with your neighbors, and it's natural that neighbors trade, there's tourism. But at the same time, the only reason Finland has maintained over the decades, even after the end of the Cold War, a strong defensive capability is because of Russia. So it is very much a two sides of a coin relationship.
And so how significant is it that Finland's now debating the merits of joining the union?
It's very, very significant. For two decades, when the Finnish population has been asked about Finnish NATO membership, 60 to 70% have been against, 20 to 30% for. And now in a matter of weeks, it's flipped. Now, most recently, yesterday, the polls showed 68% support for Finnish NATO membership, and opposition is below 20%. So it is a major shift. And of course, as befits a democracy, this has pulled the political leadership and effectively all the parties to now drive towards Finnish NATO membership in the coming months.
How much in tandem is Finland with Sweden? Will the two act on this together?
Well, that is traditionally meaning the last few years, certainly been the intent. And at the very least, that the leadership, political leadership in both countries keep each other informed. Now, this has happened. So the Swedish political leadership certainly can be under no doubt that the Finnish political leadership aims to take Finland into NATO, as I said, in the next few months. Whether or not this happens at the same time, we do not know. The most recent statement by the Finnish president, Sauli Niinistö, said that we're no longer in step or following the same rhythm. But from the little I know of Swedish domestic politics, I see it as fully possible that once Sweden really gets into gear in this debate, Sweden can catch up, so that by the end of May, we could see both Finland and Sweden having made a decision to together or at the same time seek NATO membership.
And so how might Russia react? I mean, is the fact that Finland was not part of the former Soviet Union likely to mean that the fallout wouldn't be as severe as we might expect, for instance, as we've seen in Ukraine?
Well, there's, as you might imagine, a continuous debate in Finland about this. It may make a difference. On the other hand, Russia has made it abundantly clear to both Finland and Sweden that it is a red line, and Finland and Sweden, if they seek NATO membership, it will get a response from Russia. And considering it's a great power that sees part of being a great power, self-identity, as you're being then able to impact or influence your neighbor's politics, I certainly expect a whole range of Russian responses the day that the Finnish and potentially Swedish governments formally announce they're seeking NATO membership. We have seen some indications already, but they're not entirely obvious to attribute.
And I mean, so there's clearly a danger period then between the period where they Finland and Sweden asked to become members of NATO and the actual membership beginning. They will possibly become Russian targets without any outside protection at that point.
Yes, this is another topic that's discussed a lot here. My own view, which is born out of discussions held already 2015 or so, is that the plan has been for years, and now we have certainly seen official statements to this effect. from the Finnish Foreign Minister Pekka Haavisto, as well as NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, that simultaneous to such a public announcement, at least a few large nuclear NATO members would announce maybe not binding security guarantees, because they would have to be ratified also, but a very strong message to the world that if anyone were to attack Finland or Sweden, they would instantly come to the defense of Finland and again Sweden. This would then be hopefully provide some additional deterrence to anyone. Well, of course, Russia is who we're talking about.
Mm. What would Finnish and Swedish membership mean for NATO?
Not entirely the same thing, but if we do take them together, it would certainly allow for the better defense of existing members in the Baltics, potentially Poland, Norway. It would also, I would say, just as the two members, provide two new members that, yes, introduce some new defense planning issues. But on the other hand, Finland has been planning its defense for a century now. So we have a pretty good idea how to do it well. But two military, very capable members, and members who've been contributing to a host of NATO operations in the Balkans, in Afghanistan, etc. So I think two security producers is what NATO fundamentally would get. And two countries that still, while they have no illusions about Russia, understand that you need to prepare militarily, but you also need to keep some avenues of diplomacy and negotiation open in the long run, simply to make relationships work over the course of decades.
And do you think that any countries in NATO can be expected to veto this expansion? I'm thinking here primarily of Hungary, which is Kremlin-friendly.
This has been discussed so far formally, and of course it would be their job. Finnish politicians, officials have said that they have no other indication from any capitals. And as you might imagine, the capitals have been frequent places to visit for Finnish politicians, that there are no indications that anyone would oppose this. And I don't really understand what the fundamental logic for Viktor Orban then would be to not have Finland and Sweden in NATO. And if for some reason he thought this would be kind of the cross to or hill to die on, then I imagine there are large NATO member countries that could make him potentially think again. So while it's possible, and it is entirely possible that Hungary might be given something else in exchange, I don't see it as very likely, and certainly not ultimately being the thing that prevents Finnish or Swedish NATO membership.
Charlie, thank you very much indeed. That's Charlie Salonius-Pasternak speaking to us from Helsinki. Still to come, North Korea celebrates 10 years of Kim Jong-un's leadership. Ruth Michelson reviews the day's papers from Istanbul, and we find out why it's all kicking off at London's Design Museum. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Yesterday, authorities in Shanghai began easing lockdown rules in some areas of China's most populous city, home to 26 million people, many of whom have not been allowed to leave their homes for any reason since the Omicron variant became prevalent on April the 3rd. Well, joining me now from Shanghai is the journalist Rebecca Cantor. Rebecca, what are the lockdown rules at present in Shanghai?
Well, yesterday we heard news that the government would begin easing the lockdowns. So based on, each individual housing community. So if your housing community hasn't had a positive COVID case in the past 14 days, then you have more access. You can go out on the street, but it's only giving you really access to about a 1 to 3 mile or a 3 to 5 kilometer radius. But if there's any new COVID cases, then you go back to beginning, which is, back in your home. So they're just doing a lot of testing and really trying to get every single positive case isolated.
Now, there have been reports of protests, in fact, video footage of people screaming from their balconies. Can you tell us more?
Well, I personally have not seen that at all. I definitely have seen frustration. I've seen a lot of frustration from people online, and I've seen the videos of people, who are quite frustrated yelling outside. But for the most part, I think people are very frustrated. They are not happy with the way things are going. They're really not happy with how the supply chain is just a total mess right now. Not able to get food is really stressful for a lot of people. And I think that's what that frustration is coming from. That's what I would say.
How's the government reacted?
Well, I think on the weekend, I think we heard that the government actually, they acknowledged that things are not going as they had planned. I think the Shanghai government never really wanted to do a whole city lockdown. And so in some sense, I think they were caught a little bit off guard and not prepared. I'm not sure they had a plan in place for how, 26 million people would get food. When you say you can't go on the road, when you say you can't leave your house, when you say shops all have to be closed, how do people get food?
And how are they getting food?
Well, right now, people are being very, they're all sort of banding together. All of our local housing communities, people in Shanghai live in housing communities. So all the housing communities have established WeChat groups, and people are trying to organize like a bulk buy, because there's just a huge shortage of truck drivers. So even getting food into the city and then to each individual housing compound is very difficult to arrange. So you've got neighbors, signing people up to receive oranges, or signing people up to receive a delivery of vegetables. We just got one today. The government is also giving out rations, but they are really inconsistent. So it's maybe once every few days, and sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less, and in different parts of Shanghai, it really depends on the local community government. Mm-hmm. So it's really tough. But I see a lot of neighbors helping each other out, exchanging, bartering food back and forth. And so that's how you get by, is you depend on your neighbors.
How is this affecting commercial business in the city, which is, after all, a huge financial hub?
Things are shut down. So, If people can work from home, they're working from home to the best of their ability. Factories are shut down, or if they are still running, then they have asked their workers to stay inside the factory, which is a whole, I can't even imagine being stuck at work instead of being stuck at home. But it's definitely affecting supply chains. Things can't go on as normal.
Rebecca, thank you very much indeed. That's Rebecca Cantor speaking to us from Shanghai. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has said Russia is preparing tens of thousands of soldiers for a huge offensive in eastern Ukraine. It follows reports that chemical weapons may have been used by Russian forces in the city of Mariupol. Pakistan's parliament has selected Shehbaz Sharif as the country's new prime minister after Imran Khan was ousted in a no-confidence vote. The opposition coalition leader, who'd worked to depose Khan, won the support of a majority in parliament. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said the United States is monitoring a rise in human rights abuses in India. The rare rebuke comes days after Washington was criticised for not speaking out about state-sanctioned human rights abuses. And today's Monocle Minute takes a closer look at next year's presidential elections in Nigeria. The country's trying to find a way to reconcile regional differences ahead of the contest. And you can read all about it at monocle.com/minute. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Kim Jong-un has now been in power in North Korea for a decade. He's the third generation of the family to rule this one-party state. This is a week of commemorations, which also includes the 110-year anniversary of the birth of Kim Il-sung, North Korea's founder and Kim Jong-un's grandfather, on Friday. Well, John Everard served as the UK's ambassador to North Korea between 2006 and 2008, and he joins me on the line now. John, how is this being celebrated in North Korea?
With considerable style. They've held a huge party meeting in one of their largest buildings with speech after speech of a party dignitary, and all saying, of course, what a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful man Kim Jong-un is, and all praising his achievements. I suspect that later this week we will be seeing street parties, which North Koreans tend generally to rather look forward to celebrate the 110th birth date of his grandfather. The worry is that they feel the need later to celebrate this with a large nuclear firework display.
Mm. If we could look beyond the rhetoric and just break this down, his political achievements have been lauded, but what has he actually done?
Well, yes, if you look at the way that North Korea was when it came to power and the way it is now, I think you have to conclude he hasn't actually achieved a whole lot. He came to power promising his people there would be no return to the arduous march, as the starvation of the 1990s was called, and that there will be economic recovery. That simply has not happened. In his early years, there was economic progress, but that went backwards quite quickly. And we now have the rather depressing spectacle of local party committees going from household to household saying, please, please, don't let any of your neighbours die of starvation actually on Kim Il-sung's birthday. That would be most inauspicious. Give them just a bit of food to keep them through that date, and if they starve later, well, that's just too bad. Not exactly what people hoped for.
No. What of its nuclear status?
Well, four of North Korea's nuclear tests have taken place under Kim Jong-un. All the hopes that were vested in this young man coming to power, that there might be a change of direction for North Korea, have simply been dashed. He's proved to be as obsessed with nuclear weaponry as his father was. It's clear that under his rule, North Korea has not only developed bigger and more effective nuclear weapons, but also much more effective ways of delivering them. Submarine-launched nuclear weapons, mobile launchers, solid-fueled rather than liquid-fuel propellant. He's made great strides, and of course this worries all his neighbours.
Particularly Seoul. What's his relationship like with South Korea?
Tense. South Korean President Moon Jae-in made great efforts to warm relations with the North. And we had in 2018 those extraordinary scenes of Moon Jae-in addressing crowds of North Koreans in the May Day Stadium in Pyongyang, and several summits between Moon Jae-in and Kim Jong-un. But that simply went sour. The North Koreans worked out that the South Koreans were not going to start busting UN sanctions to give them the money and supplies they wanted, and lost interest. And in recent months, the North Korean media has said very rude things indeed about Moon Jae-in. Mm. Moon Jae-in, of course, about to leave office. He hands over to President-elect Yoon in a few weeks' time. And Yoon has made clear that he is not interested in summits. He thinks that North Korea is a threat that needs to be contained.
And what about foreign policy and Kim's relationships with key players like Russia, China and the US?
His relationship with the US, of course, hit a high point in the famous Singapore summit with President Trump, but has, so we say, faded since then. We had the disastrous summit after that in Hanoi, where President Trump literally got up and walked away from the table. And the promise of the early relationship just never materialized. He doesn't actually have now much of a relationship with the United States, to be honest, or much of a relationship with Russia. Russia, of course, has other preoccupations right now. And in any case, can't really help North Korea very much. The Russian economy is just too beat up to do that. The one relationship that really, really matters to North Korea is China, which accounts for 90-something percent of all North Korea's trade, almost all of the aid going into North Korea, and almost all of North Korea's political support. If that relationship ever soured, North Korea would be in deep, deep trouble.
Now, there's been speculation about Kim Jong-un's health, and I wonder if these new portraits and exhibitions give us any further information.
Poor man. He gained quite a lot of weight a couple of years ago, and people said, dear me, he has health problems. Then he lost the weight, and people said, dear me, he has health problems. What was he supposed to do? It looks as if he has, at the very least, been on a diet. His waistline has shrunk quite a lot. Every now and then, he appears in official photographs with what looks suspiciously like the remains of a cannula, of a hospital injection tube in his arm. So he probably has had a procedure of some kind. But that's very thin gruel, and there's no real evidence, I think, that his health is particularly bad. He needs to stop smoking, he needs to lose a bit more weight, but hey, you could say that of so many other people, couldn't you?
Absolutely, don't we all? Is there any prospect, finally, John, that North Korea would ever radically change political leadership?
That is the $64 million question, isn't it? I think the only thing that will cause North Korea to radically change would be if the leadership decides that the threat from within North Korea of an insurrection is greater than the threat from without. That might just cause them to start talking seriously about abandoning their nuclear weapons and talk seriously about the reforms that the North Korean people so desperately need and so richly deserve.
John, thank you very much indeed. That was the UK's former ambassador to North Korea, John Everard, and you're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24. Well, it is just coming up to 8:37 in Zurich, 7:37 here in London. And we'll continue now with today's newspapers. And joining me from Istanbul is the journalist Ruth Michelson. Ruth, let's start by this important story about the Austrian Chancellor going to visit Vladimir Putin. It did not seem to have a happy outcome.
Well, that's right. This is Karl Nehammer's visit to Moscow. Absolutely fair that some people would wonder, why does this one European Union, the one European leader that will be willing to sit with Vladimir Putin, why was he willing to go there? Especially as we're seeing in some of the coverage, for example, CNN, that he said in a public briefing in Moscow prior to this meeting that he hadn't been following the meeting, that he was not particularly optimistic and that he believes that the offensive in Ukraine is being prepared with determination. But he said that he thought that he didn't expect Putin to change his mind because of the meeting, but that he wanted to literally sit down, look him in the eye and confront him with the facts and talk about the cruelty of war. So it seems that he thought by personalising the meeting and sitting with him that somehow he might be able to make a dent.
Mm. Well, this has been covered, obviously, all over the world. I'm wondering what the German papers said, for instance, Der Spiegel.
Yes, so Der Spiegel, which tends to cover politics in Austria in an incredibly critical and dry way, has this account of the meeting, basically addressing what Nehammer said at the press conference afterwards, that, you know, again, I wasn't optimistic, and that, you know, I believe that this offensive is being continually prepared, and that he impressed on Putin that war crimes had been committed in Bucha and in other places around Ukraine, and that those responsible must be held accountable. We are also seeing in some of the Austrian press, like the Wiener Zeitung, which has a huge picture of Nehammer and Putin on the front page, that there were risks associated with this meeting that they were very clear about. So they said, you know, there was a risk that by going, he's showing that Russia isn't really as isolated by Europe as perhaps some of Austria's European partners would like to show. And that there was also this risk that had there been a joint press conference afterwards, that Putin could use that as a kind of photo op. And so we're seeing in coverage, for example, in the Washington Post, that the Austrian side that said that there would be no joint press conference afterwards because they were worried about how the Russian side would use that and what they would show from it.
Mm. Let's move on to Pakistan now, which, of course, has a new prime minister, Shehbaz Sharif. That comes after the vote of no confidence in Imran Khan. Who is Sharif?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think it's probably quite significant that a lot of the coverage that we're seeing has in their title, "Who is Sharif?" So we know, for example, from the coverage in the Washington Post that he is part of a political dynasty where they mention that wealthy and powerful families have dominated Pakistani politics for a long time, including the Sharif dynasty and the Bhuttos. That, you know, he and his son and his political heir, who is apparently the next elected chief minister of the Punjab, have faced extensive corruption allegations. So we're seeing that also covered, for example, in the New York Times, that Mr. Sharif, they say, is the younger brother of Nawaz Sharif, who did serve as prime minister three times, and like other family members, has been dogged by accusations of, in very New York Timesian language, graft and malfeasance that were the focus of several corruption investigations.
And how about his relationship with the military? Because, of course, that's always been key for leaders in Pakistan.
Absolutely. And so we're seeing that covered in, for example, Al Jazeera. They say that he enjoys much better relationships with various parts of the Pakistani military, which is traditionally in control of foreign and defense policy. You know, they also mentioned something that's rather interesting, which is that no prime minister in Pakistan has finished a full 5-year term since 1947.
What was against Khan? Was it his, as the New York Times says, his professed mission of dismantling Pakistan's political dynasties and rooting out corruption?
Well, I mean, yes, according to the coverage on this, he came, you know, Khan promised a new Pakistan, including, you know, creation of a vast welfare state. He has a very loyal following among young people. But according to The Washington Post, you know, the economy has not the economy has deteriorated in recent months. There is rising inflation. And so he made enemies among the opposition and, crucially, as you just mentioned, lost the support of powerful members of the military.
Finally, Ruth, let's have a look at Israel, which is reeling from a wave of violent attacks across the country. What ties them together?
Well, some rather interesting analysis here in the New York Times, which would essentially say that nothing ties them together, and it is that there is some poor analysis or poor understanding going on elsewhere. So pretty telling quote in this from Ehud Yahiri, who is an Israeli analyst of Palestinian affairs, who saying, "Whoever has identified a pattern or a reason to explain why now and why this way is just hallucinating. And the most important element is how random it is." So in this analysis by the Times, they mentioned that, you know, the attacks have been carried out by vastly different people with different allegiances. So, you know, the there's the potential for copycat attacks, obviously, but at the same time, there's no evidence that these attacks have been carried out by the same network of people.
Finally, let's have a look at the Steinway Tower. This sounds extraordinary. The world's skinniest skyscraper.
Yes, also dubbed the coffee stirrer as a result. So it is a quarter of a mile tall. It is 18.3 metres wide all the way along. And apparently, as it is now open for people to move in, but if you live near the top, obviously where the penthouses are, you get an extra service that I think it's probably fair to say that people have not paid for, which is some swaying. Which is that when the it's so tall and so skinny that when the wind blows, the skyscraper sways at the top and is apparently has the risk of similar to another tower nearby that's also very tall and skinny, 432 Park Avenue. Residents who lived at the top complained that the swaying was making them, the quote here in The Guardian, is super nauseated.
And there's a New York Times piece from last year which talks about how a lot of these buildings aren't really even finished, sometimes years after they've been occupied.
That's right. So, I mean, pretty important context, because obviously we're seeing in this, you know, lots of complimentary pieces about how this tower is open and how exciting the dimensions of it are. But, you know, as the New York Times piece is essentially saying that there are a lot of these towers on so-called Billionaires Row that the city still considers active construction sites because there are potentially some safety issues to work out. And in the words of the New York Times, the stakes have never been higher, not to pun. So there's been been this surge of super tall towers across the city. It's without precedent. And essentially, in the words of the New York Times, this is exposing gaps in the city's enforcement strategy, comes with additional safety risks if left unchecked. In other words, these towers are so tall and so thin that building codes and regulations were just not constructed to deal with them. Again, no pun intended.
Ruth Michelson, thank you very much indeed. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's time to talk business now with Rachel Popazzoni, who's a national business reporter and presenter for ABC News in Australia. Rachel, let's begin with Sri Lanka. It's facing its worst economic crisis in history. What's caused this sky-high inflation?
Yeah, it really is sky-high inflation of 18.7%, Georgina. Now, of course, COVID-19 has caused an increase in inflation around the world, and that has, of course, led to some of the problems for Sri Lanka. But there's also other elements that have contributed to it. It has huge foreign loans from countries like China, going back years of government borrowing. Tax cuts have also created this major economic problem. And also a really interesting thing that happened last year was that the country banned chemical fertilizer. It wanted to become the first completely organic country in the world. But economists say that that decision has ultimately been disastrous. The country, for example, used to produce all of the rice that it needed, but in the 6 months after the fertilizer ban, the country was then importing up to $600 million worth of rice. That's about £345 million worth of rice. It just wasn't able to produce what it needed because of this ban on fertilizer. It's a country that exports tea. That's its major economic contributor. It posted a loss of almost £330 million because of the lack of being able to use those chemical fertilizers on crops. That ban has now been lifted on chemical fertilizers, but clearly a lot of damage has been done. We've got Sri Lankans struggling to earn enough money to feed themselves. Fuel, as we know, globally, costs there have soared and it is in short supply. Our correspondent in Sri Lanka has reported cases where people have died while waiting in line in the very hot sun for fuel. We've got a situation where there's power being switched off throughout the day to try to limit the use of energy. So it's having all sorts of impacts across the economy and across people's lives just in their day to day.
And what about lines of credit? Because Sri Lanka's trying to borrow, I think it's $1 billion from Beijing.
That's right. And that's obviously one of the issues because trying to get that credit when a country is in such economic turmoil is part of the problem. And so countries like China, as you say, one of those that it's trying to source funds from. And when you've got people that just can't get basic supplies because of these huge debts that the country is facing, it really is, as you said, potentially the worst economic crisis that the country is facing in its history and one that is not going to be easily overcome despite efforts to try to get credit from countries elsewhere.
Now let's turn to Australia and the housing market there. It's been described by experts as at crisis point. How bad is it?
Yeah, we've got a rental vacancy rate of 1%. This is data that's just come out today. And in some areas, it's even lower than that. And what we've seen throughout the pandemic is a lot of people moving from the bigger capital cities to smaller capital cities, but also regional areas. So we've seen where you might typically expect rents not to be in such high demand in those smaller cities and regional areas, we're also seeing massive pressure there. So rental prices nationally have risen 15% in the past year. Prices to purchase property are up more than that, 20%. So there's immediate calls for support for housing with warnings from some economists and property market analysts that we can expect to see an increase in the homelessness rate. The Reserve Bank of Australia is widely tipped to start increasing the official interest rate from June. It is yet to move on interest rates. One of I know the Bank of England has. We've seen interest rates move in the US, in neighbouring New Zealand for us. Australia's still to do that. So our official interest rate is currently 0.1%, but most major banks expecting it'll be about 2% by the end of the year. And that'll, of course, bring in some other complexities where we've got people who've taken out a mortgage for the first time over the past 2 years where interest rates have been so low. So there's a big risk that a lot of people may default on their loans. We've just launched our election campaign here in Australia for a new federal government. It's day two. There's a lot of calls for more action on how to address the major rental shortage with crisis accommodation, how to address concerns about what rising interest rates may do for the property market as well. So it's day two of that campaign, yet to see any major reform from either of the major parties. But those watching this sector closely hope that there will be some announcements over the next few weeks.
And just briefly, are Australians largely a nation of renters, or do they tend to purchase their properties?
It's very much about the Great Australian Dream, Georgina, and people wanting to purchase a property. And there's been lots of discussion over the last few years about whether that is something that is going to change, whether we like it or not, because of that affordability. Mm-hmm. We've got very high debt to income loan ratios of 6 times people's income. So it is really very much a hot environment for a lot of people.
Rachel Papazzoni, thank you very much for joining us. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Football, the world's most popular sport, has become entangled with the world of design, including everything from team badges, strips and stadiums, and from the grassroots right up to the World Cup, which is kicking off later this year in Qatar. A new exhibition at London's Design Museum, Football, Designing the Beautiful Game, tells this story and one that's much bigger than pure sport. Monocle's Robert Bowne took a look around and spoke to the assistant curator, Rachel Hayek, about putting it all together.
And we all knew it was a beautiful game, but not quite this beautiful. What a deep and wonderful show. You've got such a sort of depth and breadth of artefacts here from across the sort of history of the game and all four corners of the globe, I suppose, as well. I want to ask you first, though, if the sort of design of the game, if it started off as sort of an accidental part of it, the strips, the posters, the literature, and now it's become much more central. What's the sort of timeline?
Yeah, I think it's undeniable that the game has become, of course, much more commercialised and everyone wants a piece of the pie, so the design has become a lot more part of the industry, if you like, but it does have a very rich history. And for example, in the very first section, performance, we start a kind of innovation timeline of boots and balls in the 1870s, and we've got the Harrow School Ball, which is a wonderful object. It looks a bit like a burnt Christmas pudding caked in mud. You definitely wouldn't want to header that ball. And we go all the way up to the present day with, you know, Adidas and Nike's present tech, knitted shoes, more synthetic materials, the use of AI in training and tactics. It's kind of pervasive in all areas, as you say, stadium architecture, kit design. Design story is there wherever you look.
And it was such a sort of, seems like it's such a sort of, in terms of the fandom and documenting the game, it was such a cottage industry in the first place, you know, whether it was a sort of back street in Huddersfield or as a Brazilian favela, you know, how the, you know, fans and players or wannabe players sort of talked about it. Is this a story of commercialization, or is this a story of design kind of planting its flag in over different parts of the game?
I think as the fan is such a central component of football culture, and you really don't get that level of fan engagement, I don't think, in any other sport. And that was definitely important for us to showcase and highlight in this exhibition and put the fan, anything designed by fans, on the kind of equal footing as the, I guess, official designers, if you like, and architects that are featured. And for example, the Peter Carney banners, the kind of satirical looks that fanzines take on their favorite teams, the fan is central. So I wouldn't want to say we hope it's not a story about the commercialization, but it's a story of innovation and professionalization. And I think inevitably you're going to get some uglier sides to that as you go along.
There's an interesting point in one of the latter rooms, actually, about the sort of preponderance of betting sponsors and all the rest of it on international shirts, international club shirts nowadays. To take it back to the fan, to your point, there's such a wonderful sense of humour about a lot of that stuff in the chants, in the literature, and in the banners and all the rest of it. There's quite big, and I think the show is so strong on this, such a big delineation, I suppose, between the world of the fan and the world of the sponsor, I suppose. There's a bit of lack of sense of humour, I suppose, going on, but I suppose that's part of the professionalism of it. Is that how it felt putting the show together?
I think it was nice pulling out the story. For every I guess formal official line, you've got the fan take on things, which is often very different, and thank God it is. I think that's what makes it so fun, and yeah, there's a huge sense of humour. And as you say, with the chants, and we've got some wonderful examples. The crest and badge, particularly, I feel is a real site of protest and identity for the fans, not just to identify the teams, of course, but there have been some really nice takes on, I guess, vandalism is a strong word, but kind of riffing
on it.
I think you've constantly got this butting heads between the formal and informal. That's everywhere, even in the stadium design. You know, a lot of the time these things are just collages of appendages. As the sport grows and you need to accommodate more fans, you get these bits added on here, and you know, it might look very shiny from the outside, but actually if you look a bit closer, you can see it's just a bit pasted together and rough and ready, and it's, yeah.
Putting the show together, I mean, there are some things that you expect to see here, some of the football strips. When you're talking about stadium design, the Ibrox disaster, Hillsborough and Heysel, and these sorts of very sad things are necessarily noted here as well. What about you? What sort of surprised you that football had as a design component? I mean, I love that you've got some of the calling cards of the sort of hooligan firms coming from Southeast London. That obviously speaks to a little bit of the magic of that part of the world. But what surprised you to be hanging on the wall in this show?
Yeah, the hooligan cards are just fantastic. The idea of a hooligan or fan, you know, taking the time to design this beautiful business card, it's like American Psycho. it's very, very strange, and they're so beautiful. But I think the women's story throughout, and the kind of countless examples of the tenacity, you know, from before the ban in 1921 and during the World Cup, you know, the kind of unofficial women's federation and putting on their own tournaments, and the posters are beautiful. Unfortunately, we can't trace the designers, but I hope that this exhibition will encourage the next generation of researchers to dig a bit deeper and, you know, talk to a lot of these players are still around. You can find out their stories. I think we're getting that. The women's game is definitely gaining traction and is more popular than ever.
That was Rachel Hayek from the Design Museum in conversation with Monocle's Robert Bound. And you can hear the whole interview on this week's episode of Monocle on Culture. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Charlie Filmer-Court, Emma Searle, Paige Mennels, Rhys Strames and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our researchers, Lillian Fawcett and Samson Mbogo, and our studio manager, Christy Evans. After the headlines, there's more music on the way, and the briefing is live at midday in London. I'm Georgina Godwin, and I'll return on The Globalist at the same time tomorrow. Thank you for listening.